just to put you in the right place. Now, the Last Supper is over. That upper room discourse is finished. And as we read today's passage, the day that leads to the cross begins. This is the day around which the whole of history pivots. At the beginning of the day, we're going to read Jesus is arrested. And this part of the story might be familiar to many of us, part of the Easter narrative. But let's not be complacent about it as we come to it. As with all of the gospel writers, John's recording of events is written in such a way to bring certain things to light for us. He puts particular emphasis on things he wants us to see. So let's make sure that we are listening carefully as we listen to his unique voice as he relates this tale. As I've been looking at this passage this week, two things have jumped out at me. Firstly, the question of just who is in control of these events. And secondly, what it is that Jesus is trying to achieve. So do bear those questions in mind as we read this morning's passage. Let's read John 18. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now, Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" And they answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said to them, "I am he." Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. So he asked them again, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these men go." This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, "Of those whom you gave me, I have not lost one." Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First, they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. Peter stood outside at the door. So the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them standing and warming himself. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Jesus answered him, "I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I said." When he had said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, "Is that how you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me?" Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now, Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So they said to him, "You also are not one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Peter again denied it, and at once a cock crowed. Well, let's dig straight in to the Bible. First of 2 points this morning, verses 1 to 11, Jesus is in control, and he uses his power to save his people. There are some surprises in this familiar narrative, and I think that these surprises, and I think that I found three of them, they help us to understand what's going on here. So look at verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. And just so you remember, a few hours earlier, Jesus had washed his disciples' feet, and then he'd said that Judas would betray him. Here is our first surprise. Look at verse 2. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. Now here's the surprise. Jesus knows that Judas is about to betray him, and yet he goes to the place that he knows Judas can easily find him. If you were receiving death threats, I don't know what you do. If you're anything like, do you remember Salman Rushdie a good few years ago who was receiving death threats? He went and hid himself away totally. Nobody knew where to find him. I know that that's what I'd do. But this death threat on Jesus, well, he deliberately goes to the place where he can be found most easily. That is a surprise. So read on in verse 3. Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. In other words, they were expecting trouble. And maybe they were hoping to ambush him, pounce on him like some sort of ancient SWAT team. But actually, this isn't necessary, we find out as we read on, because verse 4, then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to them, came forward and said to them, whom do you seek? And there he is, part of that first surprise. You see, Jesus wants to be arrested. He knows what's going to happen. He goes to the place where they will find him. And when they arrive, he steps, if you like, into the torchlight. It's as if he's saying, good, I'm glad you're here. I've been expecting you. And what I think we're supposed to be asking, who is in control here? Is it Judas with the knowledge? Is it the soldiers or the officials with the weapons? I don't think it is. But for them, it's always good to make sure that you are arresting the right person. And so reading on, Jesus asked who they wanted. They reply, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus says, I am he. Now they are looking for just a man, I think. Jesus, who grew up in Nazareth, the local boy, out in the boonies. And Jesus puts his hand up and says, well, yeah, that is me. Except that isn't the whole story about who Jesus is it? John began his gospel back in chapter 1 by introducing Jesus as what? As the Word. In the beginning, do you remember, was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God, and that Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And John wants us to know throughout his gospel that Jesus has a dual identity. The Jesus of Nazareth, who they are arresting, well, he existed before the creation of the world. He was with God. He was God. He was there as God. And that maybe would explain why. You look down in verse 6, what happens to these guys when they hear him say, I am he? Will they fall down to the ground after they draw back? And this is the second surprise for us this morning. You see, when Jesus says, I am he, that is literally, I am. Now, those of us familiar with the Old Testament will know that this is the name that God calls himself. They fall to the ground because God stands before them. God, come to earth in person to save his people as he did back in the days of the Exodus. Well, now he is here to save, finally and forever, by going to the cross. And it must have been a bit of a surreal moment if you were an onlooker there. These soldiers who came in power, armed to the teeth, find themselves not overwhelming Jesus, but overwhelmed by Jesus, by his words alone. But they don't give up. Mostly that seems actually because Jesus won't let them. Look at verse 7, because again, he's like, come on, whom do you seek? Well, they're seeking Jesus. And again, he says, I am he. And he says, so if you're looking for me, then let these men, my disciples, go. And again, we come back to the question of just who is in control here. It's Jesus. Jesus is in full control. He insists that they arrest him. He insists that they let the disciples go free. What he says in verse 8, it isn't a question, it is a command. Let these men go. And John reminds us that in saying that, he's working to fulfill what he'd said earlier, this promise that he will never let go of those that God has given to him. He sovereignly cares for his people. He is in control. Everything he has said must come to pass, and he has said that he will protect his people. Isn't it good that Jesus is like that? He is the one that we can trust with our lives. He cares, and he is the control, the power to do something about it. So, two surprises. And then the third surprise comes in verse 10, I think, as Peter steps in to try and save Jesus. Look at what happens, verse 10. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. Poor old Malchus. Maybe that's a name I should give to my son, Malchus. I like that. Judas and the soldiers seem to have come expecting a fight. But the surprise here in verse 7 is that when Peter lashes out, when Peter makes this charge at them, actually he isn't getting it because Jesus wants this. Jesus intends to be arrested. Jesus intends to die. He said, look, would you deny me drinking the cup that the Father has given me? Shall I not do that? I want to drink this cup. And Jesus is talking about his death. And specifically, this cup is something that we find in the Old Testament, something the Old Testament prophets had spoken of. You go back to Isaiah, you go back to Jeremiah, and they describe this cup as a cup filled with the wine of God's wrath, God's holy anger against sin. And Jesus is saying, I'm here to drink this. And so Jesus will not let Peter save him from this cup, this undiluted vengeance of God against his enemies that must now be taken by Jesus. And John wants us to know that the arrest and the betrayal of Jesus here, well, they are not the main story that night. There was a bigger plan from before the creation of the world, and Jesus is in control. He is going to drink the cup of God's anger, and he intends to see it through. Who is in charge in this passage? Well, Jesus is, and he's determined to die. He goes to the place where they can find him. He helps them arrest him, and he won't let anyone defend him. He's determined to drink the cup of God's wrath, the punishment for sin. Now, it's easy, I think, to look at Peter in this story and to think, well, Peter's being a bit of an idiot. I mean, I think I did on first reading. Hasn't he seen the soldiers? What is he doing? Hasn't he realized that it's Jesus' plan to be arrested? And what does he think he's going to achieve anyway? But actually, on reflection, I think that Peter is pretty brave. What he does is exceptionally courageous. When Peter pulls out his sword, he must know that this is going to end badly. Oh, he might kill one or two soldiers at most before they drive their own swords through his chest. A few hours earlier, in chapter 13, Peter promised Jesus that he would lay down his life for him. And he meant it. And here he is following through. And I lament that I so often seem to lack the love and commitment that Peter shows here to his Lord. He's brave. But his bravery is also sort of where he goes wrong. He wants to give his life to save Jesus. But he's got it the wrong way round. For Jesus is here to drink that cup. Jesus is determined to give his life to save Peter and all who will accept it. So the question is, this night or this morning, who's going to be the saviour? Peter or Jesus? Peter is bold and courageous. He's going to save the day. And who of us wouldn't want to be like that? Who of us doesn't want to be strong for Jesus? Who of us doesn't want to demonstrate our love and commitment to God by our works? Who of us doesn't want God to see how much we love him by the way we boldly speak the gospel to others, by the way we defend truth at school, at work, in the public sphere? Who of us doesn't want to be a passionate and confident and strong Christian believer? Peter wanted to save the day in his own strength. And if you're anything like me, then you often wish you could just have a little nibble of whatever Peter had for breakfast that morning. But hear this. Jesus came to save us. He doesn't need our brilliance. He doesn't need our brilliant works. Jesus came determined to die. The Son of God came into the world that by taking the Father's anger at our sin, he might bring salvation to us and to this world. Peter was brave, but rather than trying to play the hero, he would have been better off listening to Jesus, trusting in his plan, recognizing that Jesus is the hero. That his heroism relieves a great burden from us. And I wonder to how many of us Jesus this morning might be saying, you put your sword away. Stop trying to be the hero. I am the one and the only one who can bring the full salvation that you need. Jesus is in charge, determined to bring our salvation, so we don't need to try and save him, and we don't need to try and save ourselves. But let's look at the second half of the passage, verse 12 to 27. Jesus is in control, and he takes the place of his people. Jesus is in control, and he takes the place of his people. Now, what's going on in these verses? Well, John seems to be highlighting the contrast between Jesus and Peter. We get a sort of split-screen narrative. It flicks between the two. He's setting them against each other, and each reveals something about the other, I think, when we look at them next to each other. So Jesus and Peter, what do? Well, they both end up at the home of the high priest. Verse 12, Jesus is bound, he's arrested, and he's taken there. And Peter, we find out verse 15, well, he makes his own way there. And he waits outside whilst his disciple friend, who knows the high priest, gets him in. And again, actually, I think we're shown a glimpse of Peter's loyalty and bravery. He is a very impressive man. And with the help of this other disciple, who may well be John himself, who wrote this gospel, he's able to sneak into the place where Jesus is being held. But on his way in, the servant girl catches him, doesn't she? Verse 17. And she says, you also are not one of Jesus' disciples, are you? And what can Peter say? Because right now, he's in serious trouble if he gets found out. It's not just him, but John as well. And he probably wouldn't do Jesus' cause any good. So he says, I'm not. A tiny lie, a tiny little lie. And he gets in. And then we go back, verse 19, to Jesus. And the high priest is questioning him about his disciples, about his teaching. Jesus responds to the high priest by saying, actually, I've got nothing extra to reveal to you. I've always spoken openly to the world. My claims, my commands, they're all public. Jesus wasn't hiding any secrets from them. And just question, what's going on behind this little interchange? Well, it seems like the religious leaders thought of Jesus as some sort of false prophet, secretly enticing people away from the one true God, an offense punishable by death. But there is no secret teaching, he says. He doesn't say one thing in private and another in public, like so many of our leaders, politicians, seem to. And actually, at this point, what does Jesus do? He turns the tables on his interrogators. So look at verse 21. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. They know what I have said. And that's not just a statement in his defense. Jesus is pointing out, actually, hey, high priest, you have no right to question me like this. And no court case can ever be held without the testimony of witnesses. Where are the people? It's actually you, high priest, who are operating in secret. Jesus turns the tables, but they don't care. And Jesus' response earns him a hefty blow from one of the officers who demands, is that how you answer the high priest? Well, that should put Jesus in his place, but it doesn't. Verse 23, but Jesus answered him, hey, if what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong, but if what I said is right, why do you strike me? Again, Jesus turns the tables. They want to sit in judgment on him, but instead he sits in judgment on them. He still has the authority. He is still in control. They claim to uphold the law, but show themselves to be dishonest and corrupt, whilst he is the lawgiver, and he acts with honesty and integrity. And so meanwhile, whilst Jesus is there maintaining his unblemished record, what is Peter doing? Well, verse 25, Peter is standing, warming himself by the fire, and he was asked again, you also are not one of his disciples, are you? And he denies it. And you see the contrast that John is drawing. Inside, Jesus is acquitting himself with honor. He's been giving himself up. I am he. What's outside, Peter is lying. It's shameful, but it happens so easily. Well, what else could I have done, maybe Peter would have said. But it gets worse in 26, verse 26, because then a relative of the guy whose ear he cut off in the garden, oh my goodness, he's in trouble now, comes up, and Peter is backed into a corner. They'll likely cut off his ear if they find out who he is, or worse. So again, he denies being there with Jesus. And as the cock crows, we are reminded how far Peter has fallen. The night is now ending, the sun is rising, but Peter must be remembering how it all began. When back in chapter 13, Peter said to Jesus, I will give my life for you. And Jesus had replied to him by saying that before the cock crows, Peter would have denied him three times. A few hours later here, it has happened so quickly. It came to be. And where did Peter go wrong? In verse 10, even, he was bravely fighting, the hero of the hour. But by verse 17, he's chickened out. He's giving up on Jesus. He's denying him. How did that go wrong so quickly? I think Peter is easy to misunderstand. We see Peter strong with the sword and then weak in his denials and think that it looks like two totally different people. But actually, that is the normal picture, isn't it, of the Christian? Brave as he is, it turns out that Peter cannot handle it himself. So yes, in the heat of the moment, with Jesus there, with the other disciples around him, he's really brave. But now, when he's on his own, and there seems to be less at stake, and not many people can hear him, he fails. He disowns the one he promised to give his life for. And the problem is, Peter's a competent, a brave even guy, but even he just doesn't have what it takes. He is totally out of his depth, and the truth is that the best of us, even the best of us, will fail at our attempts to follow through on our convictions, especially if we've misguidedly cast ourselves as the heroes in the gospel story. But when Jesus calls us from self-reliance into depending on him, he is offering to carry us, both through the times when we seem to have it all together in the garden and through the times when we fail, like here in the courtyards. And if we rely on him when we are strong, then we will probably find that we are already depending on him when we find ourselves weak and insufficient. I suspect to some extent that that was Peter's issue. He didn't realize it, but Peter had always needed Jesus to save him and to sustain him for the fight. And the solution for Peter that John wants us to know, well, it goes back to Jesus' death, Jesus' substitutionary death. Have a look at verse 14. Way back there, I don't know if you noticed, but John slipped in a little reminder of something that this guy Caiaphas had said back in chapter 11, that it will be good if one man died for the people. And John wants us to know that this is exactly what Jesus is intending as he approaches the cup of God's wrath. He has shown Jesus on trial to be blameless. He's free from sin, and yet he's determined to drink the cup that the Father has given him for the people, for the sake of the people, on behalf of the people. Jesus, who had no sin, will drink God's fierce anger against sin. He will bear the punishment for sin, though he himself was innocent. And so Peter, the guilty one, who deserves to die, who deserves God's wrath because of his sin just demonstrated here in this display of bearing false witness against Jesus will bear Peter's punishment so that Peter will go free. Even the most determined among us will go through times when we fail, when we lack the courage, the commitment, the love, the loyalty that Jesus demands and deserves. And the solution to failure is not to try harder or some great display of godliness or brilliance like Peter's antics in the garden with the sword, but actually to realize that our efforts are part of the problem in the first place. In my greatest Christian successes or in my lowest Christian slumps, if I regard myself to be close or far away from God because of what I've done, it is a deeply sinful attitude and it provokes God's anger. And the only solution is this death by proxy, if you like, this substitutionary death. If Jesus dies in my place, then I can be forgiven, I can be free. One man for the people. It's a fresh start. But more than that too, it is a whole new life, a new beginning, continued by confessing to God that I cannot make it on my own, that I can only continue every day in his strength and with his enabling. Even when I'm feeling brave and confident, I'm 100% in need of Jesus and his salvation. In a few weeks' time, we're going to reach chapter 21, where after Jesus' amazing, brilliant resurrection, Jesus tells Peter how one day he will die. He one day will give his life for Jesus. But by then it will be different because Peter will learn that he doesn't need to do this on his own. He doesn't need to do these great works of salvation. He isn't excluded from Christ either because of his failures. But he will trust Jesus' power, Jesus' plan, Jesus' salvation. And I wonder what it will take for us here to learn that lesson this morning. Peter had to be humbled, to be brought face to face with his own failings. In the space of a few hours, he crashed from hero to zero. His world collapsed. He saw that there was no room for pride in his life, that his only hope now could be Jesus' death in his place. And what about us? All of us go through times of strength and weakness. If you're anything like me, far more times of weakness. But if we think we're mostly fine on our own and just need Jesus to top up our shortcomings, then it won't work because we need him 100% of the time, all of the time. And we need his salvation every day in every area of our lives, in weakness and in strength. When I manage my life on my own, that is not a neutral thing. That is directly in opposition to God's control, to God's plan. It denies my need for Jesus. Peter's displays of strength and weakness are both the works of a man who needs to trust in Jesus. Because Jesus is the saviour of broken people, not strong people. Jesus is the saviour of failures, not heroes. Jesus's betrayal and his own brokenness was him in charge, determined to die in our place, taking the Father's anger at our self-reliance, that we might now depend on him alone, live for him alone, in his strength alone, knowing that we are sinners saved, that we are failures rescued. We don't need to save the day because Jesus does. And isn't that a wonderful thing? Let's pray.